Thank you very much, Jared, for that introduction and for setting this whole thing up. I'm assuming by your presence here that some or all of you do have some interest in public service. Of course, you're just embarking on this long journey that will end in a career and in hopefully successful and worthwhile and meaningful careers. Right now, as you take the first steps in that direction, and Jared's already left. I was about to say something good about him, but you're out there. He's back. You heard his name. You can't do much better than to talk to somebody like him. And I won't bore you with a lot of the details here. I won't take his thunder, but you really ought to just sit down with him sometime and have him describe to you the work that he did in Ethiopia over an extended period of time while he was with a law firm. And that's truly in the nature of giving back. First, again, thank you for coming. I was last in this room, actually the first and last time I was in this room before today was about 4 months ago at my 25th law school reunion. And I'm glad to say that the group that's in front of me here looks like it has more energy than that group did. It's standard practice for somebody who comes back, and this is my first time back here in this kind of capacity, to throw out a one-liner or two about the way things used to be, and oftentimes the hidden message is it was better when we were here or whatever, and it usually ends up with a lot of people in your position rolling your eyes, and it sets up a real sort of a distance between the speaker and the people spoken to, and believe me, I've been on the other side of enough of these to know that's the case. And I didn't want to start like that because my essential message to you is going to be that we're on the same journey. I'm further along than you are. But if the saying goes that if you compare it to all of human history, any particular life is like two finger snaps. Well, then just think I'm just like one finger snap ahead of you. It's an exciting journey that you're about to embark on, but it's one that I'm still finding my way through too. And it's a journey that basically that is all about just trying to reconcile making a living with making a life. And what I mean by that is trying to figure out a way that you can make enough money to sort of satisfy what you determine are appropriate everyday needs that you have, with at the same time keeping very much present in your mind the imperative that you fulfill basic obligations to your family and to your country and to your world. And the case that I wrote about and the book that some of you may or may not read is all about one very compelling and I think unique interlude in the course of my journey. And the reason why I wrote the book is that the reason why I first sat down to write it all those years ago before any kind of a publisher was on the horizon and any sort of contract was in the works was because I thought that someone else could learn from this story and might be able to learn something about themselves and about a segment of society that is oftentimes underreported. As Jared indicated, I am a prosecutor by trade. I took a leave from my job not because of the book. I took a leave because I wanted to spend more time with my kids. I've been on leave now for a year and a half. My kids have had it with me. I think they're very eager for me to go back and start like working the 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. hours that I was working before. I'd like to talk to you a little bit today, and I was very thrilled to be invited down here to talk to you a little bit about the case, to talk to you about the people that I met in the course of prosecuting the case, to talk about the experiences that I had, but with the idea ever present during the course of this talk that there is something in this story that you can absorb for yourselves, and there is something in this story that you can hopefully think about, reflect on, and maybe act on at some point when as you go through and start on the journey that you're going to be going on, trying to decide how to put your life together, whether to go into public service, and if you don't go into public service, if you go into the private practice or whatever you do, how you can devote some small measure of your life toward some small part of your life towards helping other people, giving generously, doing something that focuses on the day-to-day problems that, again, as I said earlier, are too often unreflected upon by the media and by those of us who go through our daily lives without really having had the kind of exposure to these sort of folks that I'm going to be talking about, as I had an opportunity to do in this case. Let me just go back. 1993, I was an assistant U.S. attorney. I had been working homicides for about a year or so at that point. I joined the U.S. Attorney's Office in 1987 after having been in private practice for 5 years. When I was in college, I sat in an auditorium and listened to Ralph Nader, the consumer advocate, talk about the imperative that people go into public service. I think he had a memorable line that I remember writing in a book that I kept back then, which was, do you want to go into a career and have the most distinctive part of it of that career be that someday you could sit there and tell your friends that you spent 2 years attacking the 67th count in an antitrust indictment? I wrote that down. I went to law school. I had that quote in the back of my mind. And, of course, what did I do the first thing when I got out? I joined a law firm. I spent five sometimes miserable, sometimes tolerable, but never particularly interesting years in a law firm. And I have to say, I very much appreciate the, you know, the imperatives that can drive people to that kind of madness. I did it because I needed the money. I was living at home. I wanted to be able to get a place for myself. But I always had in the back of my mind that I wanted to get into the U.S. Attorney's Office. I wanted to either be a public defender or a prosecutor. And fate took me toward the prosecutor's office, and toward a prosecutor's office, and I can, at some point, at the appropriate time, if you all have any questions about that sort of decision and those kind of choices, I'd be happy to answer them. A quick anecdote before we get to the case: two things that the two formative experiences that I had in a law firm. And again, I met wonderful people there. I still have great friends who I worked with there. But the two experiences that I had that told me that this wasn't for me, number one was when I expressed to a senior partner that I was interested in doing some lobbying work. I thought that would be kind of cool to walk around Capitol Hill and to, you know, meet congressmen and all the rest of that. And the project I put on right away was basically on behalf of a union client which was seeking to amend in the kind of middle of the night a federal statute so that different wage provisions would apply to their kind of work than previously had applied. And it became very clear to me from the start that this was not necessarily a process that was going to involve any sort of adversarial back and forth. This was essentially a do something sort of below the radar, get in, get out, get this thing amended, our client will be happy, and you go home with, you know, well, the partner goes home with more money in his pocket, I go home with the same money I was getting. The second thing I got put on was an employment litigation matter where I had a chance to have a long talk on an endless plane ride, a five-hour plane ride, sitting in this seat next to this older partner. And he proceeded to tell me about how wonderful it was going to be to do a jury trial. And jury trials were the best thing going, and you won't believe the experience, how compelling it is. It's this, it's that, it's tremendous. You know, you can use all your talents, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I was enthralled. I said to him, that's great. How many jury trials have you had? He said, two. So I knew that a law firm wasn't necessarily where I was going to be embroiled in what I consider to sort of be the kind of sunshiny, open government type of, you know, I wasn't going to be getting that experience from lobbying, and I wasn't going to be getting any jury trials out of the whole thing either. And it became very clear to me that law firms, and this is just a function of the beast, it's not necessarily anything pejorative about this, but you are basically serving one client's interests. And it was the most liberating experience for me when I got into a prosecutor's office to actually have the interests of the public at large, the interests of the residents of the city that I was working in, which was the District of Columbia, even the citizens of the entire country. Those were the interests that all of a sudden I was representing. No more narrow client interests. I suddenly had a client of 250 million people, or at least in my small segment of it, 750-some thousand D.C. residents. In the course of doing that work, I progressed through my office in sort of lockstep, as you do. And I ended up in the homicide section. And by luck of the draw, I was assigned to a case that involves the people that you're going to see right now. And what I'm going to be doing is we have a DVD here, which basically goes through the case itself. It goes through the family of the victims. It goes through the victims themselves. And it goes through how the case was put together. And I'd like you to keep in mind, and I'm going to be referring to this because I'm going to be narrating over the DVD, but this is a It's a horrific case. I'll prepare you ahead of time. It was a horrific double murder of two innocent people. It was impeccably investigated by the police. The police officers on this case belie every stereotype that we might hold about lazy cops, hitting Dunkin' Donuts in the middle of the night and then turning around and rousting somebody innocent, putting drugs on them, and then beating them up. When it happens, it's horrible. The great majority of police officers I've ever worked with are some of the bravest and really some of the smartest people I've ever met. These people are just an example of that. The family of the victims are the most inspirational group of people I've ever been around, but there are other people like them. It's a unique combination of factors that drove me to write the book. It's a unique combination of factors that I would hope people might find compelling about the book. But as you see this, this is more the norm than it is the exception. Good people basically being involved in the process and working in an imperfect but in a nonetheless committed way to try to make sure that justice gets done and that injustices are avoided. It'll take a second here. And I'm going to have to be going back and forth to this to pause it at various times. So, May 25th, 1993, that was the day when Diane Hawkins and her daughter Katrina Harris were still alive. They were living at that time in a neighborhood called River Terrace in Washington, D.C., not far from Robert F. Kennedy Stadium, where the Redskins used to play and where the Nationals play. Diane Hawkins was a 42-year-old mother of six. You'll see her depicted in a moment here. And can everyone see the monitor? At the time of her death, she was 42 years old. This is a picture taken of her the Halloween before she died. She was a member of a huge family that originally had resided in North Carolina. Her family moved to the District of Columbia in the 1940s. She was a survivor of breast cancer. She had had cancer at some point in the past and had even been told that it had recurred shortly before May 25, 1993. She was the mother of six, who were all living in a relatively small house that you'll see depicted here in a moment. She had a 10-year-old son named Rasheen, or Rock, by Norman Harrell. Norman Harrell you'll find out more about later as we go along here. She and Mr. Harrell were embroiled in a child support litigation. The case was supposed to go to court the next day, May 26, 1993. One of her daughters was named Katrina Harris. You'll see her pictured in a moment. As of 1993, she was 13 years old. Her father was named Willie Harris. She was one of the men with whom Diane Hawkins had her children. She was only in eighth grade at the time. She was a very quiet student, a very quiet person, very shy and very withdrawn, but she was just coming into herself in that spring and summer, in that spring of 1993. She got straight A's in school. She was, as I said, starting to blossom. She was starting to sort of shed some of the previous shyness that she had, and she had gone out for the cheerleading team, which everyone in the family was amazed about. And that day, or that week, she had passed up a trip to Disney World that other family members and friends were taking so that she could stay home with her mother and take care of the baby in the family, whose name is Kiki, and we're going to be finding out more about her later. This is the house where Diane Hawkins and her six children were living on May 25th of 1993. It was a three-story structure in Northeast, in River Terrace, the neighborhood that I referred to. And it was a house which basically held six, seven, eight people on a constant basis, but the huge Hawkins family was constantly in and out of that house. And Diane was the social magnet for the entire family. When I'm talking about an entire family, I'm talking 40, 50, 60 nieces, nephews, cousins who would get together on a regular basis. This is the front door of the house as we're advancing on it. This is the most tame of the crime scene photographs from the case. Diane Hawkins is lying in her living room. She had been eviscerated, meaning that there had been a cut made in her chest, and her intestines and other surrounding matter had been taken out viciously. She'd been stabbed numerous times, and her heart had been cut loose from its moorings, dropped back into the body. In other words, the heart was still with the body, but it had been cut by the killer. The viscera would be present or visible behind the door that you see right there. This is a picture of Katrina Harris, which was sitting on a table near where her mother lay, along with a Mother's Day card that Katrina had given her mother on the last Mother's Day that her mother would live through. This is Katrina Harris as she was found by family members in a second floor bedroom. This again is the tamest photograph, the least gory photograph that I could possibly put on in a presentation like this. She had also been stabbed viciously. She had also been eviscerated. She was stabbed some 37 times with two knives, and the reason why we know that two knives were used was because the knife point of one knife was actually found in her skull where it had been broken off. She had been stabbed with such viciousness. She, too, had an incision made in her chest. Her heart had been cut from its moorings and was never found. The heart was taken by the killer. These are two of Katrina Harris's siblings, and they are very relevant to this case. Kiki was the 22-month daughter of Diane. She was found in the same room as Katrina, the upstairs bedroom. She was looking down on her sister and was crying, and we'll find out more about her in just a moment. Her brother was Rico Hawkins. Rico Hawkins appearing here on the left. He was a young man who was one of Diane Hawkins' children. He was the 19-year-old son of Diane, and he actually found one of the bodies. Another family member came into the house, found Katrina, and went out, located Rico, who was with friends in the same neighborhood. Rico came in and then found Diane downstairs. This is Norman Harrell. Norman Harrell was the man that Diane Hawkins was embroiled in the child support action with. He was 44 years old. He worked as a truck driver. He had a 10-year-old son. He was the father of Rasheen Rock, the 10-year-old son about whom the child support litigation was going on. His criminal record was insignificant to the extent that it was some 30 years old, involved relatively minor offenses, no previous murder charges, no previous attempted murder charges. He had two obsessions in life. He was obsessed with child support, and he was obsessed with hunting. Now, when I say he had these obsessions, they weren't the sort of obsessions that you or I might refer to in talking about someone who's a Redskins fan or someone who likes to golf obsessively. Child support was something that Norman Harrell would talk about in virtually every social gathering to the point that he was perceived as, appropriately so, weird on the subject. He would talk about how men should not be ever forced by a court into taking care of their children. It was up to the man himself to decide whether or not he should take care of a child. He took care of his children by Diane and by another woman in his own way, which was basically just to give them money on a sporadic basis. He had been brought to court for child support by another woman and had resisted. He was being taken to court by Diane Hawkins and was resisting that. And as I said, that child support action was to go to court for the first hearing on May 26th of 1993. He was also obsessed with hunting. He would talk constantly, again, in these social gatherings that the Hawkins family would have. Norman Harrell was basically considered part of the family. He was he was Diane's boyfriend. The family was so closely knit, though, that anyone who was a boyfriend or a friend of any of them became sort of a family member or a friend of all of them. And again, there were people in the family, you know, Mr. Harrell had a sort of a rough kind of charisma in his own way, as weird as he was about child support and as sort of subtly and implicitly menacing as he could be, he also was someone who drew people towards him. But even his friends in the family thought that he was strange in terms of how much he talked about hunting, how much he talked about child support, how much he talked specifically about something he called Jamaican-style killing, which was, as he described it, the Jamaicans, allegedly, according to Mr. Harrell's view of the world, were famous for cutting their victims down the chest and then taking the heart of the victim and taking it back to whoever it was who had commissioned the killing. And he was referring to that as being the ideal way to kill somebody, and he constantly was talking about stabbings, hunting, Jamaican-style killing. He would deride the youth of D.C. who were killing each other with guns because he said that was a coward's way of killing somebody. He said you have to, if you're really a man, you should be willing to kill whatever you're killing at looking it in the eye. And he would refer to basically how he hunted, and his hunting anecdotes far exceeded his exploits or his proficiency at hunting, according to people who had gone out hunting with him. But this was one of his obsessions. This is a Ford truck, which Mr. Harrell, changing gears somewhat, would drive. It was his pride and joy. He was, the night that this happened, this truck played a very important role in the eventual apprehension of Mr. Harrell. The police got on the scene at 12:21 a.m. And immediately were able to secure the crime scene and talk with Rico Hawkins, who had found, as I said, he was one of two family members to find the bodies. The police and the book goes into more detail about this, and that's, if ever I say that, and I'm going to say it a lot, it doesn't mean go out and buy the book. It's just sort of my way of sort of, you know, kind of relating that there is more detail someplace out there if anybody's interested in it. The police did, as I said in the introduction, a phenomenal job. They come on the scene. They're able to take the most horrific crime scene that even hardened homicide detectives had ever been on. They were able to secure it. They were able to locate Rico Hawkins, who was hysterical, understandably, after having just seen his mother and sister in the state that he had. They were able to find him, settle him down, and get an account from Rico. Rico provided information, even in his hysterical and histrionic state. He was able to provide key information to the police about Norman Harrell, who was the last one. Rico had seen Norman Harrell inside the house shortly before leaving and then coming back and finding the bodies. Rico provided this information about Mr. Harrell, provided information about the child custody matter, and he did these things, and I know this is going to sound funny about it. What I'm going to say right now is going to sound funny because it's going to sound as if I'm praising him for something that I shouldn't necessarily be praising him for. But there were people who were in the neighborhood. There were people who were among his friends. There were people that were even among his family who were basically at that moment contemplating revenge. There were people who put two and two together right away, and they figured Norman Harrell had to have done this because of the way that the bodies were found and because of the child support action that he had against Diane Hawkins, that Diane Hawkins had against him, and the animosity that had developed in that relationship. There were people in the family who were saying, let's go get Norman Harrell right now and do it ourselves, because if we rely on the police, if we rely on the courts, nothing is ever going to get done. He's going to walk free, and let's do something now. Rico Hawkins, as the book discusses, didn't have a spotless background. He was someone who had gotten into minor scrapes with the law. Even after this case was over, he still continued to get into some difficulties with drug dealing on a minor level, but nonetheless illegal level in the district. He somehow found it in himself to basically trust the police at the worst moment of his life, give over a statement which was incredible in its detail, incredible in its comprehensiveness, and the police had the presence of mind in a very short time to absorb all of these details, to get information to a dispatcher, to the jurisdiction-wide dispatcher, who put out a bulletin to D.C. and Maryland and Virginia police, and they stopped Mr. Harrell's truck at 2 o'clock in the morning. Now, keep in mind, the bodies were found at 12:05, 12:10, 12:15 in that area. So a mere hour and 45 minutes later, the police already had the information that they needed put out a lookout, and very enterprising and resourceful officers on this deserted or this relatively deserted road in Maryland spotted the truck, spotted the tag number, saw it matched up, and stopped Mr. Harrell in that truck at 2 o'clock in the morning. Now, the truck ended up being all important in the case. You see here the armrest of the truck. That's the driver's side armrest. If you look closely enough, you'll see red stains on the armrest. They look large here because it's an enlarged photograph. Keeping in mind that the armrest is actually smaller than it's depicted here. You can see how small those blood stains were. The police, after having stopped Mr. Harrell, noticed inside of his truck noticed these stains, held onto the truck, had an interview with Mr. Harrell, at which time he admitted that he had been on the scene, but he denied doing the killings. But the admission that he was on the scene, and his admission that he had been among the last people with the victims was again a substantial factor in our eventually being able to prosecute the case. These stains were rushed over to the FBI, swabs of the stains were rushed over to the FBI, and within a matter of 2 days, coming up on Memorial Day weekend of 1993, the FBI had come up with a preliminary conclusion that the stains matched the blood type of the victims. And when I say blood type, I mean blood type. I don't mean DNA. This case was somewhat unique. It was 14 years ago, but it might as well have been 14 centuries ago in terms of how far the technology has advanced in just those 14 years. The first resort, so to speak, forensically in a case like this was to do just straight typing. And I'm not a little bit more refined than O positive, O negative, whatever, a more sophisticated level of serological analysis, but nonetheless not DNA. We ended up doing DNA in the case, but the first step was to do blood typing. These stains match the blood types of the victims. Now, they also happen to have matched the blood types of millions of other people because the technology for serological analysis is not so refined as to be able to pinpoint a person as DNA is able to do.
Sure.
Yeah, I'm fine. If anybody has any questions as we go along, I'll gladly pause this. This is where Norman Harrell was living. He was living about 2 miles away from where Diane Hawkins was living. That morning, that very same morning, May 26th of 1993, the police executed a search warrant at Mr. Harrell's house. This was following their interview with him. The police found knives and various sharp objects. I'll explain the significance of that in just a moment. No murder weapon. The whole point of finding, the significance of the sharp objects and the numerous, we're talking about as many as 15, 20, 25 different types of knives, including everything from pen knives to swords and everything else. The reason why we seized those and why we ended up introducing them into evidence was not because we believed that any one of them was the murder weapon. We believed that Mr. Harrell had had an opportunity to get rid of the murder weapon before being stopped by the police. But we wanted to bring them in, the evidence, and we wanted to argue to the jury that whoever did these killings was someone who was very comfortable with sharp objects, was very adept at using them, and so for that reason they were relevant, and for that reason we brought them in. We didn't find a murder weapon. We never found a murder weapon. But what we found, in addition to the knives and the sharp objects, which was significant, was this. There was a hunting manual found in Mr. Harrell's bedroom. A hunting manual bore his name at the top, written in pencil, Norman Harrell. This is a page from the hunting manual. It describes the way that, and I don't know how many hunters there are in the room or anyone who's familiar with hunting, but it describes the way a deer, for example, is field-dressed. In other words, how they're cut in the field. And it concludes this description. The carcass can now be rolled on its back. It's kind of hard to see this right now. In order to pull out the heart, liver, and lungs, it is necessary to reach deep inside the chest cavity. Don't be squeamish. Just roll up your sleeves and go to it. Most of the entrails will pull away without difficulty, but may require a bit of cutting at the back. As you've probably already seen from this, the hunting manual described virtually to a T the same kind of cut which had been placed in the bodies of Diane Hawkins and Katrina Harris. They had been cut in a Y, with a Y incision, not to get too graphic, but they had been opened up and their entrails had been taken out of their bodies in the same way as the same way that game is field dressed. Mr. Howell's fingerprint was on the back of the page that I just showed you. Now, one thing that is important, and I'm probably way ahead of myself in terms of giving you guys any kind of lessons about, you know, how you handle a trial or, you know, whatever. Some of you are going to be in court quicker than others. Some of you are never going to go to court. But the one thing that, as a trial lawyer, you have to do is you've always got to make sure that you don't oversell your case, that the jury doesn't believe that you've exaggerated the importance of something that turns out to be not as important as it was. We had to concede, because it's the truth, that a fingerprint can remain on a page for years. Paper is one of the best surfaces for absorbing a print, because the fibers of the paper actually intertwine or meld together with the oils which left the print to begin with. Other surfaces, the handle of a gun, for example, not as good a surface because it's not smooth and there's nothing. It's not porous and there's nothing that lets the print sink into it. We never argued that fingerprint had been put on that page a day, 2 days, a week or so, whatever, before these homicides. We were able to argue, though, that the hunting manual, by virtue of the fact that it had Mr. Harrell's name on it and the fact that it had his fingerprint on it, this showed that he was familiar with that process. He was a hunter. The manual is in his house. And I'll never forget, I had a conversation with the FBI fingerprint technician about that page. And, you know, he'd gone through page by page by page trying to see if he could find any prints on it. I said, are there any prints on that page, which I believe was page 67, say. He said no, but there's a fingerprint on page 68. And it turned out that the fingerprint was in the same position on the back as your index finger would leave if you were turning the page. So it ended up actually being even better than if there was a print on the front of the page, because as the fingerprint analyst explained when he testified and he showed the jury, that you would leave that print on that page, on the back of that page, in just that position if you were turning the page as you naturally turn pages. What we're about to see next is some footage which puts all of this in context. This is news footage from Channel 9, Eyewitness News, I believe it was called Eyewitness News back then, on, again, the morning after. As you watch this, the one thing to keep in mind is not only is the crime indescribable, not only is the police work on the case also just exemplary and noteworthy, but the reporting here is top-notch as well. Virtually every fact which the reporter gives out turned out to be accurate, even though this was put together a mere hours after the bodies were found and after Mr. Harrell was stopped.
Stabbed to death. The victims, 42-year-old Diane Hawkins and 13-year-old Trina Harris. They were found slaughtered inside by one of Diane Hawkins' nephews.
He said he came in, the door was cracked, and he thought someone opened the door for him. They saw him coming, and he went in the house, he went upstairs to the bathroom, he came downstairs, got on the lights, and he saw blood everywhere. They heard the baby crying. When he heard the baby crying, he went upstairs and he found Trina laying upside the bed up there. And then he just panicked and just ran out of the house.
Both victims had massive cut wounds to the chest.
At about the same time Diane Hawkins' family prayed in Northeast, Prince George's County Police, acting on a D.C. police lookout, spotted the pickup truck of Ms. Hawkins' former boyfriend. He was detained for questioning, but has not been charged. Family members say Diane Hawkins' ex-boyfriend was known to be here at the house as of 8 o'clock last night. It is unclear why he was here. It is estimated that the murders took place between then and 11 o'clock.
She worked hard and raised her to try to give him a better life, you know, better than what she had, you know. You always try to give your children a better life than what you had, you know. And I don't know what went wrong, you know. She tried, she did the best she could do with what she had. And someone took that from her. And we want to know what happened.
Diane Hawkins, the mother of six children, had been involved in a dispute with her ex-boyfriend over child support payments. Trina Harris, an eighth grader, was an A student at Woodson Junior High. They come from a large, close-knit family. Today, many of their loved ones gathered, reminisced, and helped to preoccupy Ms. Hawkins' youngest daughter, two-year-old Kiki, who was found crying inside their home late last night.
That's what the families are for. We get together at times like this and hug each other and grasp each other and, you know, let everybody know how they feel.
And she's been there for me through thick and thin. She came around to talk to me at times when I was down and out. And when I came over there to see her, she was always there for me, laughing with that pretty smile and always brushing me off by giving that little tap and that smile. That's one way I remember her as.
Every time you see Diane, she had a smile on her face. She's just a fun person. When you're down, she lifts you up.
I'm Gary Reels, Channel 9, Eyewitness News.
Now, the only fact I should just point out that was inaccurate, and it was probably just a function of one person talking to another person who then passes something that's somewhat inaccurate to the reporter. Mr. Harrell was seen at the house sometime after 11, and the bodies were found after midnight. But with that exception, that was an incredibly factual account put together under time pressure and in a very short amount of time. I need to set up what you're going to see next with a little bit of a background discussion about how I came into this case and who the people were that I came to meet and how our lives intersected in a way that I could never have predicted ahead of time before getting into this. They, as I said and as I've described, they were incredibly loving and generous and supporting and nurturing and encouraging group of people. I ended up, and the book relates about how during the course of prosecuting this case, my father was diagnosed with cancer, and I had and my relationship with this family changed over time. I saw and still see as a prosecutor, one of my primary functions is basically explaining the system to people and making them believe in it, making them believe that good things can come out of it, making them believe that they can walk away from an experience like this and have some sort of sense that justice was achieved, and making them have a sense for how the process is going to work and the very important role that they have in that process. My relationship with most families that I'm involved with in these cases is, I don't want to say one way because I learn from all encounters, but it is basically me in the role of trying to help them through what they're going through. I was sort of on the opposite end of the sort of treatment that I usually give to others in the sense that I ended up really relying on and drawing strength from and encouragement from and support from this family, the strength that they showed through the course of what they were going through. I mean, my father was 70, 71 years old. He had smoked all of his life. He ended up developing lung cancer. His illness was tragic to us, but it was not unpredictable. They had two of their family members snuffed out, one in the prime of life and one long before she even got to the prime of her life. And yet the strength that they showed and the incredible religious faith that they carried with them was something that I looked to as a beacon during the ordeal that I was having. The next two things that you're going to see here are just an indication of, first, the pain that they went through, and second, the exaltation that their faith allowed them to experience in the course of their rituals of commemorating and burying their loved ones. The first is some footage of actually the wake of Diane Hawkins and Katrina Harris. This is it's unheard of for a prosecutor to come into possession of this sort of tape. It came about because there was a domestic violence public service group that was in town in D.C., heard about this killing, made it their sort of mission to go around and document incidents of domestic violence and their consequences, and took this tape of the wake of Diane Hawkins and Katrina Harris, and also you'll see next the funeral. And all I ask you to keep in mind as you're watching this is the incredible extremes of sort of the gamut of human experiences here, from great sadness to still nonetheless a sort of a very encouraging and uplifting ceremony you're going to see after that. Now, I can't speak for anyone in terms of what sort of burial rituals you have in your faiths. I was raised a Roman Catholic. I'm still a practicing Roman Catholic. I'm still proud to be a Roman Catholic. But we are muted by comparison in how we bury our loved ones. And having buried both of my parents and seeing up close, you know, just the difference between that ceremony and this, I told a friend of mine not long ago when I was showing them this, and I said, look, when I go out, I want to be buried like this. I don't want to go out the way the Catholics are going to bury me. Find a Catholic church that's going to bury me like this. This is what I came, this is what I came accustomed to experiencing with this family, in many, many, many encounters over a long period of time that I knew them. The many conversations I had about what they had suffered, what their loved ones had suffered, conversations I had about my own situation. This sort of bedrock religious faith came out over and over and over again. And, you know, as a parenthetical here, I should just mention one of the things which drove me to write this over a period of years was that I probably haven't kept it too much of a secret here. Crimes, black on black crimes in the inner city are not reported, I don't think, with the same energy, the same devotion that crimes that involve affluent people are. That's just a fact. I wrote about this in the book. I didn't do it justice. You can't do a scene like this justice. I did my best. To see it, though, that's when you come face to face with a way of going about bereaving and a way of going about confronting tragedy, which is uniquely African American, and it's something that the everyday person who basically is just accustomed to seeing, this is the phrase that's out there, missing cute attractive white blondes, which is what the media is obsessed with. Natalie Holloway, I mean, one after another, you always have the media sort of focusing on the richest, the best looking, the most affluent, the most prominent, the Anna Nicole Smith, et cetera, whereas stories that are that involve lower income minority folks who suffer great tragedies doesn't really seem to get. I don't see Dateline running around putting this kind of a story on, and the small extent that my book serves as a window into a world that people aren't used to necessarily seeing on the nightly news, that makes me feel good. Now it's easy, it should be obvious, I guess, anybody here, that once you've gone through an experience of seeing this kind of thing and meeting these sort of people, you do everything you can to make sure that the person who took those loved ones away from them is going to end up being prosecuted if you're convinced beyond a reasonable doubt, beyond all doubt, as I was, that he had done this. But this was not a risk-free or problem-free case, even though it sounds as if we had some things going for us. When Harold was stopped by the police, there were no bloodstains found on him and no signs of any struggle, even though obviously there had been a melee inside the house. His clothes weren't bloody, and of course we didn't have the murder weapon. The DNA numbers were relatively low, and I'll pause this for a moment just to describe what I mean by that. We did do DNA on the bloodstains. The bloodstains did, the DNA results helped us, but they were also inconclusive to some extent in that the technology just wasn't where it is now. Back then, we could show that these were, to put it simplistically and not necessarily statistically accurately, there was a 50-to-1 chance that it was anybody other than Katrina or Diane, or 100-to-1 or 500-to-1 or whatever. Now the numbers are in the billions, the gazillions. You know, you can pinpoint, you can actually state with complete certainty that by DNA, this particular bloodstain is linked to this particular person. We didn't have that back then. And in fact, one of the DNA numbers was a coefficient which was shared by Diane and Katrina, Diane Hawkins, Katrina Harris, and 15% of the African American population, which is a couple of million people. So they were not the numbers that we would have now. And He bore, as I said up front, he bore no signs of any kind of a struggle. We ended up arguing to the jury that he had had time to get rid of his, change his clothing, get rid of the evidence, get rid of the bloody knife, and in the process get rid of the heart, which we knew him to have taken out of the house. But it was still something that had we had any of those things, it would have obviously made our case much stronger. And finally, there's a disconnect between Harold's background and the depravity of the murders. By that I mean he was a truck driver. He's 42 years old. He was a father of several children. He was married, and he was also someone who didn't necessarily fit what is the stereotype of a serial killer or a killer of this kind of brutality. People tend to think that they look at this crime scene, and we knew going in we were going to have to deal with this sort of predilection of our jury, and we knew that we were going to have to sort of confront it. He didn't seem like somebody that stereotypically is responsible for something like this. People tend to think of your serial killers as like Beelzebub, walking around with like bloody fangs and, you know, dragging a long tail or something like that. Many of the most horrific murders, though, as we all know from, you know, instinctively, they do tend to end up being committed by just average, everyday, ordinary people who are just, how many times do you see, you know, somebody describe, oh yeah, he was a loner, he kept to himself, but he seemed like a nice guy, and he's the person that the police find with a headless torso in his basement or something like that. But nonetheless, he was able, Mr. Harrell was able, through the skill of a very good defense attorney, who did exactly what she should have done, he was able to portray himself as just an everyday working class guy. And it just so happened that there was going on at the same time in this neighborhood a drug gang which was capable of violence and which did in fact commit murders. And one of the challenges that we had was to basically disprove their guilt at the same time that we were establishing Mr. Harrell's guilt. Now, in the course of putting this together and trying to sort of reconcile all of our evidence and figure out what we could do, how we could go about doing this, there was one person that we needed to interview, even though she was only 19 months old, and that was Kiki Hawkins. She was found in the same room with her sister Diane. I'm sorry, she was 22 months old. She was found in the same room as her sister Katrina. We knew that she had seen what happened. We knew that she was a very smart young girl. Even though she was only 22 months old, she could recite her ABCs and count to 10. My son was not 22 months old at that point. I remember when he got to be 22 months old, saying to somebody, well, he should be reciting his ABCs and counting to 10, because, you know, Kiki can. And, well, no, Kiki's, your kid's here, Kiki's up there. Yeah. But she was extraordinary in terms of what she could do, how she could already rationalize things. She had already told an aunt that she had seen Danky do something to Mommy, and Danky was Harold's nickname. We really felt that we would be remiss if we didn't try to talk to her about what exactly had happened. She was the only usable eyewitness that we were ever going to have. And even at 22 months old, we thought it was worth interviewing her. And in an interview kept falling asleep. We would get her to a certain point where she would actually seem to be ready to talk about what happened, and then she would literally just drop off. And I'm talking about as if somebody had stuck a needle in her arm, and she'd go to sleep. And so then we would go back, and we had an aunt, a favorite aunt in the room, helping us with the interview. And we would, as we would go through it, we'd come up a little closer, and then what about Danky? And then she'd drop off again. And we had a psychologist in the room as well who was saying this is a classic defense mechanism that she's engaged in. She is psychologically shutting down. I've been asked how could you possibly think that you'd be able to put a 22-month-old on the witness stand? And while it would have been extraordinary, there have been cases where someone who is as young as 4 years old, 3 or 4 years old, has been allowed to testify. You may or may not have learned that it's called competence. If someone is competent to be a witness, that means if they can, if they know the difference between a truth and a lie, and if they can testify, if they can describe something in a narrative. That's basically all the law requires for somebody to be a witness. We knew that her competency would be determined at the time of testimony, not at the time of the incident that she was testifying about. In other words, if the case took 2 years to go to trial, she was then four or so, it would be easier to get her to qualified as being competent to be a witness. But once she kept on falling asleep, and given everything that we were going to have to be going through, we made the decision not to even try. We talked to a psychologist who said basically, she can, you know, we will be able to work with you to get her to a point where she can describe to you what will happen. But to make a long story short, it would have cost her some other needed therapy that she was going to be, that she would otherwise have gone through, and we decided we'll make the case without her. And I never regretted it, but it was something which, it was an interesting interlude, and it was something where basically we were giving up our, what would have been our best evidence. And ironically, our suspicions about Kiki's brilliance were established when sometime after all of this happened, after our interview, she was riding around in a car with the same aunt, and she said, just out of nowhere to her aunt, "He would have killed me too, except I played dead." So a 22-month-old child describing what had happened, what she saw happen to her daughter and her mother, her sister and her mother, but having the wherewithal, and whether it's true or not, to even be able to voice that concept. So I remember the day that somebody told me about that, and I just thought, she saw it, you know, she's the witness, she's our witness, but we can't put her through that. What we did next, it was something that we were trying to do basically in the absence of eyewitness testimony. We did everything we could forensically to put the rest of the case together with what's called circumstantially. And what we ended up doing was using a science called blood spatter analysis. And it's literally the taking the pattern that blood stains leave on a crime scene and establishing the events, coming up with a theory as to how what sequence the events took place in. This is a diagram of the first floor, which is where Diane Hawkins was found. And I actually am going to have to, I'll sort of shorten things up here because I think I'm coming up to what would be the end of all tolerable, patience on your part. But I'll go through a very quick analysis of this, very quick description of this, and anyone who has any more questions about it can just ask me about it at some point, whenever you want to. We basically took the diagram of the first floor, the diagram of the second floor. We had already had crime scene technicians mark on diagrams the location of various stains, also, we had a blood spatter expert go in and photograph all the stains inside of the house. And when I'm saying photographing, they took hundreds, literally hundreds of photographs of just almost like inch by inch by inch around the house. We were able to take a look, meaning the blood spatter guy, the smart guy, he was able to go through and look at the pattern that the stains were making and put them together. And I'm not saying that we were arguing to a jury, this is exactly what happened, because you can't do that. You can't just take like random stains, random pictures of stains and interact with a diagram and then say, this, ladies and gentlemen, is 100%, proof positive that things happened in this way. But we were able to use he would say, for example, there is blood spatter consistent with blood having been thrown up against this back wall, the front wall, the living room wall, and that is indicative that a bloody object, i.e., like a victim's head, was being hit from this distance. We were able, there was that. There was, for example, there was cast off blood on the wall leading upstairs. The expert could even get into the speed with which that blood had to have been cast off of an object. We tied that in with the fact that Harold was, at that point, by our theory, chasing Katrina up the steps. The pattern that that the blood made on the wall behind where she was found was consistent with it having been left by her fingers, and they were fingertip width as she was clawing against the wall with her own blood on her hands, trying to get away from Harold. There was a blood drop which was found in the kitchen, which helped us tie into what Harold's movements were inside the house and what he was doing as he was trying to get out. There were smudges on the front and back doors, which suggested to us how he tried to get out the back door, couldn't get out the back door, went out the front door. There were blood stains which connected him up with activity in looking for a container to take the heart out of the house. And this is sort of, and the great thing about this is that unlike the stuff on CSI, most of which doesn't happen and can't be done, this was stuff that does happen, can be analyzed, could be put together, and there are just amazing forensic technicians who are brilliant at this stuff, and they do it every day, but it doesn't involve millions and billions of dollars worth of technology such as the type that CSI CSI producers seem to think that every police department has at the tip of their fingers. I'm not going to get into the trial because it was a month-long trial. I feel like I've been up here a month already, and I don't think anybody wants to hear me for more than a couple of more minutes. But the trial is described in the book and all of the ups and downs. And we ended up winning. All right, I don't want to take away the surprise, but I don't want to send anybody out here thinking that I hid the ball. I'm happy to talk with anybody about the whole trial experience, about putting the case together. I think I'm pushing up to the limits of my time here. But the one thing that I want you to keep in mind is, as you go about, I don't know how many here are first years, second years, third years. All right, you're still coming to class. You want to see me here at 6 o'clock? Nothing else to do. Yeah, they have wine and cheese. You all have a lot of time to put all this together. And God knows it took me 5 years after law school to get around to what I actually wanted to do. But, the experiences that being a prosecutor have afforded me are something that, I wouldn't be who I am, and I wouldn't have the life I have, if I hadn't gone through them. I wouldn't have met the people that I've met. I wouldn't have felt that I had done the good that I think I've done in some small way. And whether you're a prosecutor, whether you're a defense attorney, whether you go into public service, whether you don't go into public service, don't forget the folks like this. Don't forget the everyday working people of, white, black, Asian, whoever. But the everyday people who Nancy Grace doesn't know about, who Court TV doesn't know about, who aren't on all the cable shows. But there are real life people who put up with difficult situations every single day. The people in the Hawkins family are not particularly well off. They're not well off at all. They're middle class. Some of them are lower middle class. Some of them, as much as I love them, have gotten into scrapes with the law. Some of them have things I hear about here and there. But by and large, it's an incredibly decent, hardworking, and inspiring family. And the good thing, the good news, is that there are thousands and thousands more just like them. They are unique to me because I'm close to them, and they're unique to me because I think that what they went through was then that much worse than the average homicide. But anytime you lose a loved one, it's very difficult. And I've sat across from more bereaved families than I want to remember. And what comes out over and over again is the basic decency of people and the basic strength and the basic faith that everyday folks, even in the worst areas of our inner cities, have. And I learn as much from them as they could ever learn from me. I learn lessons that don't have anything to do with the law. And that's the kind of experience that you can have in my job, and I think in a lot of public service jobs. So, are there any questions? I sort of rushed things there at the end, but yeah.